General Bell, my first contact with him, as I've explained, was in at Leavenworth, where I really didn't know him personally, but he took some action in connection with my affairs. Then later on in the Philippines, when I was left in command of the larger portion of troops, I say in command, it was all done indirectly, of course. Now, when I came back from the Philippines, and he made me his aide in order to retain my services in order, in connection with the two training camps for the West Coast, I came to know him very much better. But when I was first made his aide, I was not with him at all until the close of the camp at Fort Douglas, Utah, which was in the early fall. General Bell was a very remarkable character. As a fighter, I don't think he had many equals. He held the Medal of Honor and should have been awarded it on several occasions. He was attacked by many older officers, particularly when he won preferment and promotion over their heads. But actually, he was so far ahead of them in ability that there was no question about it. He, fortunately, came into the service under the present General MacArthur's father, General Arthur MacArthur, and who admired him greatly and who recommended him for the promotions, first as a general officer in the volunteers and then as a general officer in the regular army when he was in his early 40s. That is, General Bell. As I say, he was a superb fighter, and in time he came to tell me, through my questioning of a number of performances, which were always referred to as being foolish, crazy things, and actually they were very, very clever, and as well as tremendously courageous. He won his great fame through the command of a regiment which was organized in the Philippines by General Bell, and the men were selected from the National Guard volunteers, and it was a superb regiment of all selected men, admirably suited for that sort of a camp, for the sort of campaign that developed. I had a great admiration for General Bell's fighting qualities and his aggressive leadership. I don't think that he was a success as chief of staff. He tried to handle things too much by personal association and by letters, and he was having a hard battle with General Ainsworth, that which was the preliminary to the final battle, which took place between General Wood and General Ainsworth. All of General Bell's efforts to modernize the army were being ruthlessly attacked by those who were opposed to anything of that sort, largely because they didn't want to do it themselves personally. And when I met General Bell, he had already been chief of staff, he had already been in command in the Philippines, and he was had returned from the Philippines and been given the command out in the West Coast with his headquarters in San Francisco. His trouble, if I can so characterize it at this time, was that he was too apt to engage in lengthy speeches. He had made a very successful one on one occasion at the request of Secretary of War Taft to take his, Taft's, place on a train trip they were going on when Taft had to make a speech at some point, and General Bell went out and made a top-line speech. The trouble was that started him on making speeches, and he overdid it very badly, but nobody could tell him so. And when I became his aide, I was getting pretty well along in years for that sort of duty, And I, with some hesitation, but nevertheless with a firm intention, I made it plain that I thought he was making a great mistake in making these speeches. Mrs. Bell was shocked that I, a comparative unknown, should dare to make such a criticism of General Bell. But I was convinced that that was the trouble, and I thought that was my duty to tell him, and if he didn't like that, he could relieve me as an aide, because I wasn't after that kind of a job. But we got along. Mrs. Bell didn't like me at all at first, and afterwards we became devoted friends. In our San Francisco associations, it was the opening moves which finally led up to the declaration of war. And we were in San Francisco when Wilson made his famous speech. Whereupon General Bell was ordered to the East Coast to replace General Wood, who was relieved from command in the then Eastern Department and assigned to a command of a former fraction of it, where with headquarters at Charleston, South Carolina. I've already described, I think, my arrival, in Governor's Island and General Bell's placing me in a pretty strenuous position while he went off to the hospital. I remember then that I would go up to the hospital every other day to see him. It was quite a long drive and took quite a lot of time. And the visit there always took time because he was intensely interested in everything that was going on. And I tried to tell him exactly what it was, and particularly to tell him of the displeasure of his senior staff officers with the fact that I was doing several things. One thing at this time was very interesting. His other aide had taken all of the supply estimates for these training camps of 2,500 candidates each, and boiled it down until he had it on the basis of 100 men. Everything down to the sheets of paper you had to have: pads, pencils, mattresses, pillows, kitchen stoves, everything was included in it. Ordnance, rifles, uniforms, nothing was left out. Well, it was really a very valuable work. And when we came into this Eastern Department, we were quite certain that the thing wasn't heading up right, because there were so many complaints coming in right away about the lack of this and the lack of that. And when we went to ask the staff about it, these older staff officers, these senior colonels, they just turned us down as not knowing anything about the thing. So I had the aide with the list visit each camp, see what they have, and then telegraph me what was lacking. And they could calculate it on this business of 100, what was needed for 100 men. And we found the lacks were very, very serious. The first one that required immediate attention was there was not enough blankets, not enough mattresses, and not enough pillars for the candidates that arrived over Plattsburgh, where there were two camps, 2,500 each, and which lacked all these things to keep a man warm. He had no pillow on his bunk. Many of the bunks had no mattresses, and they all lacked the necessary number of blankets. Well, by multiplying it out on this list we had, he could telegraph me exactly how many to send. Then we began to experience the first knowledge of what the war shortages were really going to be, though it started in this very small way. We found we couldn't get the blankets. First, the quartermaster didn't have them. Next, the shops in New York didn't have them. And we were getting mattresses and blankets and pillows from as far west as Chicago in order to provide for this camp, first camp up at Plattsburgh. Well, there were camps all scattered about the country, and maybe they were all similarly short, but we didn't know at that time. So these telegrams would come in with great frequency, about an hour apart, really, telling me of these new lacks, and these particularly serious lacks, which affected their health in that they couldn't keep warm and would stir up a terrific reaction. I found that trying to get these things, I wasn't making much headway with the staff, and I directed that everything be sent by express. And that raised a racket right away, because they said that would be very expensive. Well, I didn't think expense was going to mean so much here with these men freezing up there. The reaction, public reaction, was going to be very severe, and the men would probably all get colds and things of that sort, pneumonia. So I would direct these things to be sent by express. And then when we couldn't buy them around New York, I had them buying them out in Chicago. And I, as a matter of fact, personally sent out there to locate where we could buy blankets, where we could buy mattresses and buy pillows and things of that sort. And then I would send the note over to the quartermaster, this old colonel, to buy these and ship them by express. Finally, he came over to see me and told me that this was very expensive, and he knew what General Bell's orders were, but he wanted to bring to my attention what I was letting the government in for. And I tried to make clear to him what he was letting the government in for if he didn't have the proper things there for those men. And finally he said to me, "Well, you must understand that we've been here, I myself, several years, and we originally supplied these camps with what we thought was necessary. Now you come in with definite amounts of all sorts of things, and about every hour you have a new amount. So how can you possibly believe that you're right?" Well, I pulled him out this list that is based on 100 units and told him my other aide, the other aide had the other end of the list, and he was visiting each post. Well, he had never seen such a thing. And of course it was a gold mine of information. And he asked me if he could borrow it. I said, "Well, you can take it over there and type it and then send me back my copy." But that's where this is coming from, and we know what we're talking about. Well, that made quite a change in him right away, because he saw we really had something he didn't have. And he was very much reassured, and went ahead from that time on filling the orders that came in over my desk. You see, I had to give the orders in General Bell's name. I tried to tell him a little of this when I went to the hospital, and he got excited and proposed all sorts of peculiarities to the thing, and which we couldn't manage. And I just didn't answer those, and when the time came around, went ahead the way we were doing, till we finally got out of a out of our jam, but we had to do this for the camps around near Washington, and down in the South, and all over the Eastern Department. This was my introduction to the office there, and along with that, as I've already referred to, came the terrific pressure to be accepted in these camps. And everybody who was anybody, in a sense, was trying to get in, and each of them seemed to feel that political pressure was necessary. And I was trying to demonstrate that it wasn't necessary. We'd go at these things just on their face value, and without any resort to reaction to pressures. I found myself then up against ex-president Mr. Taft, for example, and one of his constituents, maybe it was his son, Richard, and I think it was his son, and others, particularly from the wealthy of New York and J.P. Morgan Company and people of that, officers of that power, all seemed to think they could get what they wanted right away, but just by the stating of their desire. And I stood this off. I guess I probably stood it off better than General Bell could, because I didn't know him and they didn't know me, and I could go right ahead. But it was a very, very strenuous procedure. As I say, I was using three phones at the time, and I was being seen by everybody that came to the island, so it was exceedingly hectic, and I had to learn how to do business very quickly. I had had this in San Francisco just before we left. And matter of fact, I'd gone ahead on my own and rented office buildings across the street from us, because I could see right away what was coming. And I put a lot of reserve officers on duty there, and we got started for the flood, which is about to break. Now I'd like to recite some little thing that happened that always gave me much pleasure afterwards. Before I left San Francisco, I very hurriedly dictated a number of letters to the various people around headquarters, thanking them for their courtesy or whatever it was they'd rented for me. and I did it in about an hour in the late afternoon. And then I remembered the telephone operator, that she'd been very efficient, and when I'd call up to get anybody, she'd get them with her anywhere in San Francisco. She'd locate them in a barber shop or wherever it might be. So I dictated a letter to her and told her that I had never experienced such high efficiency from a telephone operator. I had never seen her, didn't lay eyes on her then. And I dictated this letter to her and signed it and sent down that afternoon. Then I went home. And then the West Coast rain came up that night. It was raining very hard, and I was out at Fort Mason at the foot of Van Ness Avenue. And there was a knock at the door, and I went to the door, and here was this little woman. I guess she was about 45, 50. And she was wrapped up in a raincoat. And it was a terrible night out, very hard driving rain. And I brought her inside, and I discovered that she was the telephone operator. And she said she'd been there, I don't know how many years, I think maybe I would say 25 years. And that was the first time anybody ever thanked her for what she'd done. So she came out in the rain to thank me. That made quite an impression on me, and it controlled a great many thanks to people like that in future years in my dealings. However, when the future years began to come around, after the First World War was over, General Pershing and myself were in San Francisco and staying with the commanding general out at Fort Mason, just next door to where I had been living at this other occasion. The commanding general's wife, and incidentally he'd married rather late in his career, was a great friend of my sister's back in Pennsylvania. So that threw us together in this momentary time we were there, which incidentally was at the time of the death of President Harding. He died in San Francisco, if you'll recall, the Palace Hotel. And I was involved in that very heavily, in the arrangements. So I told at the table this story of the telephone operator, which had occurred at the outbreak of the First World War, which was now over. The general's wife was very much interested in it, and she said, let's go up and call on her. So she and I walked up. I had never seen the woman since that night, never heard of her since that night. And we found these two elderly women at the telephone switchboard. And of course, the particular one was very much gratified to have the commanding general's wife call on her and to see me again. But she told me they were in a bad way. There was a new lieutenant in the Signal Corps just come on duty, and he was going to get rid of all the women. And that meant that she and her old friend were going to lose their jobs. She, after some 20-odd years. Well, the commanding officer general's wife was much excited, so we went right back to the house and found the others still at the table, General Pershing and the general, talking there. And she told this story to the commanding general, who immediately issued an order through his aide that these women should never be discharged except with his personal approval. And that was to be by voice and not by paper. So then we went back up again and saw them again and assured them that their jobs were secure. That's the end of the story, so far as I'm concerned. I never heard of her afterwards. But it was always a very satisfying memory, that little incident. However, I left San Francisco that morning after the call of the telephone operator and went directly to Governor's Island. General Bell, as I said, came up from Kentucky and just paused long enough to arrange that I should exercise command in his name, and then went to this hospital, though no one knew where he'd gone. They thought he was off on some trip, though actually he had a developing case of flu. I've already described what was going on. The next thing of excitement that occurred was General Pershing arrived, headed for Europe. I found out that he had asked for my services. He didn't do it personally, but his chief of staff did, his new chief of staff, General Harbord. But when General Pershing found that I was with General Bell, he had them drop the request, and therefore I didn't go, though I didn't know of it at that time. General Pershing arrived in civilian clothes, a straw hat, and we put him on the ferry boat at Governor's Island at a secluded dock and sent him over to the Baltic, which he boarded for his trip to Europe. Then I received a telegram that I was requested, my services requested by General Seibert, the man who built the Gatun Dam, the man whose camp I had been required to inspect out in Del Monte, California. He had asked for me to go, and I was to report to him. Actually, I didn't find him where they told me to report to him, and he came in on a train later. He had paused long enough to get married, which had mixed up the appointments. And as I had the only desk around the neighborhood, he made my desk, my services, the headquarters of the troops just coming in to go to Europe in the first convoy, which was the 1st Division, was to be the 1st Division. And they had called on the training camps. I think each training camp was to send 200 candidates, we'll say. I don't remember what it was, 25 or 200, but anyway, a very small number. And these were to be the needed second lieutenants for this first unit, which had very low officer strength, and we wanted to go with full war strength. And all of these lieutenants were directed to report to me at Governor's Island. So these fine-looking young men, the pick, about 2% of 2,500 from each selection, and they were perfectly splendid-looking men. I remember the first 10 that came in, every one of them had gotten married the minute they got the note, and they came to New York and reported at my desk, and I gave them the directions as to when to report back to me, because their unit wasn't sailing yet, and I was going to sail with it, and which gave them 2 or 3 days of liberty in New York with their brides. Of the 10, I lost track of 2. The other 8, everyone was killed in the 1st Division. I might say that they all had their brides with them when they came to Governor's Island. I was only able to find about 3 hours of clear time to go to New York. And my purchases, my actions there have always, I don't know whether you'd say interested me or been a satisfaction to me. I first went to the Jaeger store and bought a Jaeger blanket, which I still have, which took me through France very warm, and soft like silk almost. I bought 3 suits of Jaeger underwear, which almost bankrupt me, and 2 suits of Jaeger pajamas. Both the underwear had a very peculiar history, because it began to shrink from very bad washing in France, and finally it would always get to the point where, unless they put a big V in it down there, in the shoulders, I would have my chin on my kneecap. These things got so shrunk that I finally had to give them up and couldn't wear them any longer. But it enabled me to go entirely through the First World War without a cold. And I think I was about the only one out of 2 million that didn't cough every morning with a cold. We got on board the Tenedores, and I was in the same stateroom with Leslie McNair, for whom the old War College site is named, and who was killed by a bomb in France, and who was wounded on a reconnaissance in Africa before that, and who I had put in command of all the ground troops in the United States, their training and their organization, with General Mark Clark as his assistant. Also was General Frank McCoy, who I got on a more intimate basis of acquaintance with him at that time. He had just come out of Mexico as attaché, and General Pershing had sent for him. And he was, so he was on this boat going over to join General Pershing, who was a ship or two ahead of us. The man we found had been given their arms on going to the train. They were about 20% of the original regiment. The rest of the regiment had been taken to form new regiments. So they're just all but 20% of the new of these regiments were recruits. And it was quite a messed up affair when they arrived in Hoboken. They had no knowledge of how to drill, no knowledge of how to handle their rifles, and they were 80% of the strength of the companies. Together with the fact that all the men loading the ship seemed to be bull-necked Germans, it wasn't a very encouraging outlook as we loaded at night there into the next morning and finally got underway on this secret departure. We were taken up the Hudson and anchored right off the Grand Monument and visited by excursion boats the 2 days that we remained there. Finally, we started out, and I felt the ship moving, so I thought I'd get up and see this affair. It was certainly historic. Our troops were going to Europe, and I got out on deck, and it was about 4:30 in the morning or thereabouts. Anyway, it was just dimly light. We got down the river and anchored, apparently. Anyway, we stopped opposite Governor's Island, and we had to wait there, and I discovered they were waiting because the chain that was being put across the harbor to check a submarine entrance was either being unfastened or fastened, I don't remember which. But I know something occurred there that I never forgot, because it was about as significant an indication of our complete state of unpreparedness as I've ever seen. I was standing up under the bridge, and they had mounted a 3-inch gun on a pedestal mount on the forward part of the deck. And these trim-looking naval files under a naval non-com were rigging up the gun. And having dealt with this multitude of recruits in this regiment as we had, and their complete ignorance of their weapons or anything, I thought to myself, well, thank goodness there's one thing that's organized, the Navy. Just then the captain called down to this yeoman or whatever he was in charge of this detail and said to him in a very, very strong voice, he said, have you your ammunition? And this fellow in a rather effeminate voice replied, no, sir, we haven't any ammunition. And I thought, my God, even the naval part isn't organized here, and we're starting off for Europe. It was altogether a terrible exhibition of our paucity of means with which to go to war. And it caused General Pershing, aside from the fact that the men were hard to handle in their lack of training and all, but it made a terrific impression on the French command when they saw these recruits in the 1st Division, because they'd been told the 1st Division was a seasoned division of regular soldiers. Well, you'd have to go around there with a microscope to find a regular soldier in the 1st Division. So that the impression that they all got of what General Pershing would have to offer them was colored by this terrific showing of unpreparedness of the troops of the 1st Division. We were given as we sailed, in fact we didn't get to open the things until we'd gone to sea, or at least gone down the harbor, and we discovered we had units on paper that we'd never seen or never heard of. I remember the trench mortar units, the 37 millimeter units, and several others. We'd never heard of them, and here they were on papers, but there were no weapons and there was no unit. We were organizing on the ocean. We had no knowledge of whether we had any of these weapons on board, and actually we didn't. And it was certainly a demonstration of complete and utter unpreparedness such as I've never dreamt of in my life. I had found out in the records that the first expedition going to the Philippines before the fall of Manila. Only had 150 rounds per man and were going 7,000 miles from home when the battlefield allowance on the wagon trains and other things on the soldier and all was something like 600 rounds. And here they were going to the Philippines with 150. Now, I've just recited the exhibition that we had to give in the 1st Division in going to France. And I repeat again that this cost General Pershing a great deal because it shook French confidence terribly, as they thought that was the American army, and nothing we could tell them made any impression. We described how we're getting these officers in this 6-month course and starting new camps all the time with those officer camps. That made no impression on them. They couldn't conceive of an officer in 6 months training, and some of these were only 3 months training. Altogether, anybody who went through that first affair got a dose of unpreparedness such as you'd never forget. I didn't realize then I was going to have one after another, and several when I was in responsible position for all this affair, and yet I'd have to find some way to crawl out of the difficulties. The same thing went on when we got to France. When we landed, by a fortunate coincidence, I was the second man ashore. I was just behind General Seibert on our first expedition when we landed in San Nazaire. And when we finally got permission to go ashore that evening, some of the officers, and walk about the town, it was very depressing. They had just gotten news of the terrible losses on the Somme when the Germans had thrown back this offensive that developed afterwards they'd learned all about before it started. And every woman seemed to be in mourning, and everyone seemed to be on the verge of tears. And the one thing we noticed most of all was there was no enthusiasm at all over our arrival. The Canadians had come and were going to settle the war in a month or two, and nothing happened. Now the Americans had come, and they were going to settle the war right off, and nothing happened. The whole thing was a very depressing affair. And the surroundings, everything about it, our first taste of the effect of war, particularly on the rear areas, left a lasting impression on my mind, and a deep sympathy with the French, and I think of an understanding such as other officers in high staff positions and had not gone through that affair didn't comprehend, and were rather intolerant of the French in some of their peculiarities, which were not peculiarities to the French, but they were to us. And I might say everything in the way of large war measures were a peculiarity to us. As long as I'm on the trail going to France, I might continue with that. On the ship, of course, the submarine war was at its worst. I think they were sinking 100,000 or a million tons a month, something like that. I think it was a million tons. And the ocean was just full of German submarines, and they didn't have the proper protective measures at that time. So it was a perilous trip. We had a cruiser leading us, the Kearsarge, and two others as the wings of the convoy. Then finally one night the ships opened fire on the supposed approaching torpedo, which had everybody very much stirred up. And I wrote in the war diary about this, and then I wrote in the war diary the next day that they determined that it was porpoise and not a torpedo. And then I found that this had been radioed home from the ships and had stirred up a grand to-do in the United States. So when we pulled into San Nazaire, the place was full of rumors from the United States side on what had happened to us and what was happening to the other convoys. And one of them, right after that, was struck by a torpedo which had troops on it. And that, of course, stirred up a grand to-do. Fortunately, they didn't have any major troop sinkings during the war, though they had tremendous sinkings of cargo boats. And I think that was the principal happening on the ship going over. And one thing was we were trying to study up what we were in for, And we found there were practically no textbooks of any kind on this trench warfare that we could get our hands on. Finally, one Englishman on board, I think he's an attaché, he had something that they printed at the last minute, and everybody wanted that at once. And it was entirely on the trench warfare, which later became the great argument between the French and General Pershing, because he didn't want to specialize in trench warfare. He wanted to get into the warfare of maneuver. And the French felt, of course, that he'd, not knowing anything about the situation on the front, was hazarding something that was no chance of putting into effect. Same thing came up in regard to target practice. They only had short-range target practice, and I had to arrange the target ranges for this purpose, and there were no long-range target fields that I could get my hands on. They didn't have big reservations like we do. They had a much more economical, and I thought, fine arrangement, whereby you could take over an area for maneuvers by certain advice and arrangement through the political setup. When we got to Saint Nazaire, as I say, it was a state of considerable confusion, but the first thing that happened to us was they began taking men away from the 1st Division, because the General Pershing's staff had gone over there, 50 men, and I understood they said the United States, that is all he needed. But he had to get men for all the various things and setting up offices and all. The only place where he could get them was the 1st Division. One way to get the additional officers from the 1st Division. Now, I'm very hazy on the figures, but they told him, I think at the first, that 40 men was sufficient, and actually 40 officers. And actually his GHQ down at Chaumont was something like 2,000 officers, or maybe more. And there was similar other groups at other places scattered over France. And now they were trying to start out at 40. So they took them from the 1st Division, till the 1st Division literally was stripped of all officers. And they took the men. They were doing port service in London, in England, and all up and down the coast of France. And the strength of the 1st Division was getting lower and lower all the time. I went up to Paris, and in time to arrive there for the Bastille Day parade. I remember General McCoy, Frank McCoy, got me my first Sam Brown belt, which I wore for many years, longer than I should have, out of sentiment. And I probably put this on for the Bastille Day parade. We were only in Paris a few days when we started out by motor car for Gondricourt, south of Bar-le-Duc. I've forgotten how far. And north of north of Chaumont, which later became the headquarters, and that was north of Long, which became the great school headquarters. I became very much involved with all these things at the start, and I was also involved in locating the first four divisions to arrive in France. I was just given the job of locating them and seeing what they needed, so I had to figure out what was required in the way of mess halls and bunk houses and headquarters and hospital buildings and everything of that sort. And nobody advised me. They didn't have time. They just told me to do it. One of my old friends, student officers at Leavenworth, John Palmer, who was one of the fine intellectuals of the Army, was G3 at that time, and he just sent me a telegram that they could give me no advice, just to go ahead and do what I thought was wise. So I had a pretty large order for a young officer there, and I proceeded to undertake it in as large a way as I could. The only trouble was I got everything fixed up for these four divisions, and I didn't realize that nobody had fixed up anything for the 1st Division. So it was behind, my own division was behind all the others in getting the necessary things. And they had to do a great deal of work for themselves, and the training program was intense, and that made it very hard to conduct the work. I know they ate in the rain and the mud for a month or two under miserable conditions, because they didn't have anything to even put a shelter up for a roof in which to serve the food. The kitchens were out in the weather, and the men were out in the weather, except as to their billets, which were largely in barns. But we had all this to learn, and I got a pretty heavy dose of it, because I say I was not only G3 and later, and then for a time, acting chief of staff of the 1st Division, but I was dealing with this French division, which was its headquarters recorded with us, and it was trying to take up our training in trench warfare when we hadn't even been trained in squads left and squads right, and we were trying to get organized in the way of supply and things of that sort. We had two automobiles, I think, for the entire division, and they came from the Marine Corps. This regiment, the 5th Marines, came in with us and was attached to the 1st Division at the start. So, of course, it lost its two Cadillacs, open Cadillacs. It was a long time before the 1st Division got any motor cars at all. And it made it very difficult because the telephones, we had to use the French phones, and of course they were overloaded right away and were not built for any such services we inflicted on them or for any such tirades as they heard. We called it the pa-phony service because that's about all we used to get over the phone. Altogether, these various affairs were very instructive and very trying. And the trouble was the GHQ, never having dealt with anything like this before, never having dealt with a mobile division in such a way, except when it was camped at down in Texas, imposed demands on us that we couldn't possibly meet. I remember one occasion, General Pershing was suddenly coming up with Joffre for a review of the division. And the Secretary of the General Staff, who happened to be General McCoy, that was a colonel then, called me up and said General Pershing and Marshal Joffre would be there at 8 o'clock in the morning and to have a review of the division. And General Pershing had sent word that he wanted the division to pass in the shortest possible time. Well, the division at that time was scattered over a strip of country about 30 miles long and about 20 miles wide. There were no motor vehicles of any kind. Two units I found, one of them was a Marine unit, had been marching all day to get back to their billets before dark, and I managed to catch them on the road at the end of the march, and they had to march all night to get back to the place for this review. I made a guess at that. I didn't have time to go out and look at one, and I had to get orders to all these various units by horseback, any way we could get out to them, and this telephone service, which was abominable, so as to get them all started back, and they had to, all started in, and they had to march all night. A great many of them had been down at this exercise, whatever it was, and they were in the process of marching home, as the Marines were. So they were very much exhausted, but they had to start right back. And during the night, they got back to this place that I'd selected by guesswork, and I got out there and found it was up on a hilltop, but that the ground was so soggy you went into it up to your ankles every step. In some parts, you couldn't get over. Along with this, I had General Pershing's instructions that this was to be the shortest maneuver in the shortest possible time. So that I arranged the division so that the preliminary review took place in one formation with the reviewing officers at one place, and the march by took place of the reviewing officers at another place. That made it possible for the division to move into review formation from where it was standing without marching around at all. And that saved the large body of troops. That saved a lot. We didn't have the artillery with us then. It was training in the south of France. But we did have a lot of horse vehicles. All the machine guns were hauled by mules. All the 37 millimeters. And there were a number of horse transports involved in the thing. And all of the wagon trains we had to get into it. So that I fixed it so that after the presenting the division and going down the front of it if he wished to, which he did, that all I had to do then was, if I moved the reviewing party to another spot, was to have the division perform what was in effect squads left, and march by in review, in column of squads, in mass formation. Well, that didn't take very long, though it took quite a while with this large body of troops. I think there were about 18,000, maybe 20,000, 20,000, I guess. The only thing missing was the artillery. And General Pershing was stunned with the rapidity of the affair, because they just marched right by and the thing was over. And he turned to me and said, "What is this?" I said, "That's the end of the review, General." General Seibert didn't answer, because he didn't know. I didn't have time to consult him on any of these things. And besides, he was having a very hard time with General Pershing, which later led to his relief. And General Pershing said, "How could they march by this?" Well, I said, "They were stationed in position up there, and the executor squads left and came down here. And the machine gun carts are all in rear of them and could turn that way, and there's no other way to do it. And that was the shortest way that the review could be managed, and those are the instructions that I got from the Secretary of the General Staff." Well, General Pershing was in a thoroughly evil humor then, and he couldn't do much to me, because I had merely done what they said, and he was taking it out on General Seibert. He came back in a few days, again on short notice, to see an exercise in trench warfare, where they use the short-range bombs, not the offensive bombs, and so you could throw them, and still, if you were could dodge behind the trench, you could get out of the way. And Roosevelt's battalion had just been down there and performed such a operation, which they'd worked out themselves, which was the custom for that sort of thing. It was the first one to do it, and he was from quite a distance off, and I called him up by telephone if he could get his men down there to do this for General Pershing. It meant they had to march all night, and his enthusiasm was very great. So Archie was in this too, so he and Archie and their outfit came down, this battalion, to put on again this exercise in trench warfare. I'm telling this because it had quite an interesting sequel to it, and I'll have to be forgiven for the very personal phase of the thing, because it affected me personally very much. Well, it was a triumph to have anybody ready to do this, because the rule of these things, as they were just like a trained course, took a week or more to organize for. And here we had only doing the night, and the night was spent in marching. But Theodore got down there with his troops, and General Pershing came in on the train. General Seibert was late getting to the train, so I received General Pershing at the train, and General Pershing was furious that General Seibert wasn't there, and I didn't know what to say, and General Seibert gave me hell for going down to the train ahead of him, so altogether I was in very bad odor and trying to do my best under the circumstances. So we went out to this place where exercises to be conducted. There was a trench system out there that the French had dug for us. They called it Washington Center. And Roosevelt had trained on that, and the men were familiar with it, so he was ready to go through his exercise, and quite thrilled that he was to put this on for General Pershing, and he'd gotten his men all thrilled. He knew how to stir up morale all right, and he did it very well this time. So when they General Pershing got out there, he had his chief of staff, and he had several new staff officers who later occupied very important positions there, who had just arrived, and this was their first visit to anything of this kind, and their first exhibition of anything like this trench affair. Now, in the rest of this, I might get some of the details wrong, descriptive terms which played quite a part in it, but I'll do the best I can. The men went through the exercise. There was a lot of shooting, of course, and a lot of dashing around from trench to trench, and a lot of grenade throwing and general hullabaloo, and then it was all over. Then General Pershing said, "Assemble the men, assemble the officers." So they assembled the officers, and he said, turned to General Seibert and says, "Conduct the critique." Well, General Seibert hadn't had a chance to even see the exercise, and he started to say two or three things, and it didn't go fast enough for General Pershing. So he directed a young officer who was in charge of the exercise to, with Roosevelt, to give some of the critique, and he made a pretty good stab at it, but still wasn't satisfactory to General Pershing, and he just gave everybody hell. And he was very severe with General Seibert, very severe in front of all the officers. And he, among other things, he said that we didn't show any signs much of training. We had not justified the time we'd had here, and we didn't show an awareness of the things. They said, you've changed the names of things. You call a dump, which was a supply thing for either supplies but generally ammunition. You've given a new name for a dump, and you've given a new name for two other things. I've forgotten what they are now. And he generally just scarified us. Didn't give General Seibert a chance to talk at all. Our chief of staff then, who had succeeded me, was a permanent colonel. And he had just arrived, and he was rather deaf. And he hadn't heard all of this. And when General Pershing dismissed General Seibert, in a sense, with a word, turned to the chief of staff and began questioning him, he wasn't quite aware of what had happened. He hadn't heard it all. And he hadn't been there but about 2 days. He didn't know what the devil was going on. And he got pushed out of the way in a hurry. So I decided it's time for me to make my sacrifice plain. While this sounds very much of a personal thing for me to put in here, I do it with apologies. It's the only way I can tell it. But I heard of it many, many times from various officers in the division. I went up and started to talk to General Pershing, who dismissed the chief of staff and rather contemptuously, and was going off. And I came up to him to intervene and intercede, as it were, and explain some of the things. And he didn't want to talk to me. He shrugged his shoulder and turned away from me. And I put my hand on his arm and practically forced him to talk. And I said, "No, General Pershing, there's something to be said here. And I think I should say it because I've been here longer." And he stopped and he said, "What have you got to say?" Well, I said, to start with, we have never received anything from your headquarters. When I was down there a month or two ago, 2 months ago, as a matter of fact, 3 months ago, I think, I was told about this platoon chief's manual that was coming out. It's never come out yet. He turned to one of these officers and he said, "What about that so-and-so?" And so-and-so said, "Well, General, we've had trouble with the French printers. You know they're very difficult to deal with." And General Pershing turned to me and said, "You know, we have our troubles." I said, "Yes, I know you do, General. I know you do. But ours are immediate and every day and have to be solved before night. Now, we've never gotten your platoon manual. We've made the best we can of this thing. The only thing you've gotten out was to change the names of the dump and everything. And now you're criticizing us for using the names you changed." And he turned to the chief of staff and he said, "How about that, so-and-so?" And so-and-so said, "Well, he'd look into it." And I said, "You don't have to look into it. It's right here in the orders. It's a fact. It's here. That's the only thing we've gotten from you. Now we're being harassed for that." I said, "We've had a very hard time. We've worked very, very hard. The men have had no advantages of any kind, and they don't expect any. But I said they ought to get a fair deal at any rate." And I just was mad all over, and I thought I'd gotten it up in my neck. I might as well not try to float, but to splash a little bit. And I've forgotten all I said, but I had a rather inspired moment. And the others were horrified, and General Pershing walked away from me by saying, "Well, you must appreciate the troubles we have." And I said, "Yes, again, General, but we have them every day and many a day, and we have to solve every one of them by night." And then I left. Then everybody bade me farewell. I was had to be relieved. They all came really very seriously. General Seibert was very regretful that I'd done this, and some of my bosom friends came up to me and said, of course, I was finished. I'd be fired right off. And, I said, all I can see is I may get troop duty instead of staff duty, and certainly that would be a great success. General Pershing never mentioned this thing to me until years afterwards. And then he recalled it. And his comment on me was that I was pretty hot. Well, as a matter of fact, it made quite an impression on me, because instead of ruining me, he sent for me quite frequently. And when he'd come to the division, he would get me off, away from the others, and talk to me about the condition of affairs, particularly when he thought the Germans were going to attack us up at near Cantigny in order to administer a damaging blow to American morale. As far as I could see, it helped me rather than harmed me. But it gave me a key to General Pershing's character, which I found held good all the way through. I've never seen a man who could listen to as much criticism, as long as it was constructive criticism, and wasn't just being irritable or something of that sort. You could talk to him like he was discussing somebody in the next county, and yet you were talking about him personally. Might be about a social thing, certainly about official thing. You could say what you please as long as it is straight constructive criticism, and he didn't hold it against you for an instant. I never saw another commander that I could do that with. Their sensitivity clouded them up so that it just wouldn't work. I've seen some that I could be very frank with, but I never could be frank to the degree that I could to General Pershing. I know the members of Congress were so astonished when he was having his hearings that I sat next to him with General Fox Connor on the other side, that I could interrupt him and talk to him and tell him about something, then he could turn around and tell them. He had no hesitation at all of receiving suggestions or advice from me or from the others about him. And it is one of his great strengths that he could listen to these things. You might get irritated because he didn't do them right away. He always seemed to be very sluggish in finally taking action, but it was pure efforts that he was just about right as to the timing. The fact that you could talk to him with such frankness meant everything in the world in getting along in such a difficult situation. Now, the remarkable part of this was I was a comparative stranger to him. And because he never called me in to GHQ until he never called me in to be his aide until after the fighting was over. He called me into GHQ just about the time of the Soissons fight and put me in the operations section under General Fox Connor. And General Elling sat in with them a good bit. He was deputy chief of staff. And that was my introduction to GHQ. I left that and went back to the First Army, became chief of operations of the Army, and later chief of staff of the 8th Army Corps. And then General Pershing's aide. I've digressed considerably here, but I guess it's all right. That, in a way, is the way we started in France. The soldiers were immediately inflamed against the YMCA. Poor YMCA couldn't get the people. It had to have a great deal, and it had to be sent from the States in a large measure, and it seized whoever it could get in France. I remember the son of the ambassador was there, and they drew on him to help them there in their YMCA hut, and he was immediately stirred up great criticism because they thought he ought to be in the ranks. They were utterly unreasonable about this. That's the way soldiers go, and I found exactly the same thing later on in the Second World War, and I found the same thing when I came in as Secretary of Defense in the Korean War. They are very quick to get worked up to something that they think is not quite as it should be, or is to their disadvantage in particular, of course. This was very pronounced over there with the YMCA. It undertook the contract to do all these various things and was given a certain allowance of tonnage, which I think was something like, I think it was 130 tons a day, and it was cut down to 30 tons very shortly after that, but its obligations were not cut down at all. I know the one to show you how these things went. The Red Cross ran a couple of plays which were very good. The Salvation Army put on one play only, beautifully put on, cost quite a lot of money, and I think the YMCA had to put on 260 or 620, I've forgotten which, and was responsible for all of them, and had this reduced tonnage and everything to battle with. It is for the reason of the feeling stirred up by these various organizations, the Red Cross, the Knights of Columbus, the Salvation Army, one or two others, I believe, that the General Pershing made these recommendations, which was followed, that there'd only be one organization in the in another case of that kind, and this would be the Red Cross. Well, I was interested to find, when I came into the Red Cross, into the Korean War, or no, when I came into the presidency of the Red Cross, to find exactly the same reaction against the Red Cross that there had been against the YMCA, and for exactly the same reason, because they had undertaken all of the obligations, and of course they had all kinds of difficulties in carrying them out. So they were turned on, and I found when I became president of the Red Cross, I had quite a battle with the reporters who were all violently against the Red Cross, particularly if they had been servicemen. And it was unjustified in the extreme. But it was exactly the same reason that had turned them on the YMCA and favored the Red Cross in the First World War and the Salvation Army and the Knights of Columbus. They were all the favored fellows. Whoever's put in that position is bound to catch a very bad reaction. Quartermaster generally gets it. Commissary sometimes gets it. The staff at headquarters always gets it. That's one reason I constantly change the staff officers and brought staff officers from the outside in and overseas into the Pentagon and sent the others a third at a time out to the other staffs in the field. I think I've given a fairly good account of our arrival over there in France and some of the conditions with which we had to contend. I went up for my first experience in a battle with the Foreign Legion of the Moroccan Division, and I saw them in their fight at just west of Verdun. The western Verdun defenses is the time of the great attacks in August. August 20th and 21st, I think. The artillery preparation was a week long, or 5 days long beforehand, was considered the greatest artillery preparation in the history of warfare at that time, and the greatest concentration of guns. And I was with the headquarters of the Moroccan Division, and during its advance, later on, I managed to get away from headquarters and to follow it up, and I had a most interesting day in following through after the fighting, in which it received its third citation, which gave it the Medal Militaire, which was the first division to receive that, as I recall, in the history of the French Army. I may be off about this.
You want to go on any other reel?
Yeah.
You are. You can still talk yet. A little bit.
Stop it a second. Right. I'm going to jump way back now to a note I see I hadn't touched on. It was on the training camp in Fort Douglas, Utah. I was taken away from the camp in Monterey and